Здравствуйте! С Варшаем в очередной выпуск All Else Equal. Сегодня ко мне присоединились товарищ Рид и товарищ Винстон. Welcome back to another episode of All Else Equal. I'm joined today with Jason Reed and John Winston, or Comrade Reed and Comrade Winston. Today we're going to talk about radical wealth redistribution, or maybe something else.
Yeah, in the past two episodes, we've discussed the first three dialogues of Angrynomics. We've discussed the author's stance on a perceived increase in public anger, both moral outrage and tribal rage. In the last episode, we outlined the author's whirlwind history of macroeconomics from 1870 to today. I think it's fair to say that we disagree with some of the author's claims and points of emphasis. You guys agree with that?
I say we break the hardware and we create a Soviet America.
That's good. So all of this episode is going to tie back to radical redistribution or movements towards Stalinist Russia.
Thank God.
We were done with that.
Just like last episode. I think the way the authors have kind of tried to set up, which is a very difficult task, this idea of outlining these different notions of anger and why they've increased. I think anecdotally, all of us like feel the polarization that's going on. The book is going to be limited in some sense by a lot of this stuff is going to be storytelling. I kind of like this idea of like tribalism and moral outrage, although it's not clear like what the distinction between those are. Any whirlwind history of macro is going to have limitations. I think we did a pretty good job of trying to point out last time that the authors may have like a somewhat leftist or demand side leaning, but the story's not wrong. I mean, like the things mm-hmm. they point out aren't not important.
I guess I've just seen some books make these connections a little bit better instead of just relying solely on kind of story and anecdote. I mean, we interviewed someone earlier this year who wrote a fantastic book about kind of the political economy, and it was based all on surveys that he wrote in the field. And so every story that he told could connect immediately back to research that he was conducting. And I'm not asking, you know, these authors to be, you know, academic researchers, but it would have been nice to see a little bit more connection.
I think, you know, if you go to the notes section, there's 33 footnotes throughout the book. Like, that's not many citations for a book that's making a whole lot of claims.
Yeah.
I highlighted one claim, the footnote 25. They're talking about robots and employment and how people are concerned about this. And the footnote, if you look at it, it says, a search of the Financial Times archives from 2009 to 2020 on the topic robots and employment yields 403 results.
Thanks.
I don't know really how to interpret that. But again, like, I mean, they have a tough task, right? Their job is to do this. I mean, they're doing a bit of economic history. They're doing a bit of, you know, psychology. They're doing a bit of policy proposals. So we have to cut them some slack there.
All right. John, what are we doing today?
So today we're going to discuss the fourth dialogue, Microeconomics, Private Stressors, Uncertainty, and Risk. I think the authors do a nice job of setting up the chapter with the first two paragraphs on page 89. I just realized I didn't have my book with me, so give me a
second. That's okay. We'll cut this.
A book to your book club.
In the last dialogue, Mark, Eric speaking, we made the case that Angrynomics is generated every time that the global economy has a major crash. This is a macro story that relates to what we have called public anger. Macro crashes release public anger. Macro crashes that are patched up, as was done after the 2008 financial crisis, may suppress that anger, but unless the sources of legitimate public anger are addressed, there is a risk that the system destabilizes and is hijacked by tribalism, which is what we see at the moment. So now let's turn to private anger in Angrynomics. Earlier, we made a distinction between private and public anger. Private anger tells us about internal stresses that individuals face. Anger in our private lives is indicative of the fact that we are struggling. We seek counseling and help. We are encouraged to calm down and to address the anger's root causes. In the public sphere, moral outrage is something we will defend. It's something we are almost proud of. Public anger seeks a solution to a public wrong. The object of private anger, our family, friends, work, colleagues, is really the root cause. Private anger seems to be the end of a continuum that starts with stress. And in this dialogue, we should try to get a sense of what is causing elevated levels of stress and how this links to the economic causes that are contributing to angeronomics as a personal lived experience.
All right, so the authors are going to kind of then set out this idea of, there's this like idea of cognitive effort, which is sort of a mild statement, which they're going to link to like saying, like basically the fact that like people don't like uncertainty. And when they face uncertainty, it stresses them out. And so on page 91, they're going to set up that there's three types of uncertainty. And then later on, which is what the bulk of the chapter is going to be, is they're going to talk about kind of the four preconditions for the, that have generated these three major causes. So on page 91, first full paragraph, Mark says, I think there are essentially three major causes behind our anxiety and stress. Things go wrong in our lives. Small things like cars breaking down down through to big things like illness and job loss. Not knowing what's happening in our lives, especially uncertainty about the future and unexpected changes in our environment. Obviously, these three factors are all related. Rapid change in our environment creates increased uncertainty and potentially increases the outcomes that may hurt us, in addition to the increased cognitive effort we may need to make as a result. And then there's going to be this, that immediately goes to this discussion of risk and uncertainty for the next few pages, which is a little bit strange from my perspective. Jason?
Well, why? Tell me why you think it's strange.
There's a couple things. I think the first thing is that like immediately after that, they say like, okay, there's this difference between risk and uncertainty. Like if I'm at a roulette table, I know that if I bet black, my chances of winning are something like 49%. That might not be exactly right, but I think it's something like that. That's risk, right? I can calculate the probability that I'm going to win. I can calculate the probability that I'm going to lose. It's easy to calculate. And this notion of uncertainty is that like, you know, I go into this game and I don't know the rules and I don't know what the probabilities are. And so I don't know the probabilities. And just to kind of quote the last paragraph on 91, it starts with economists have hijacked the terms risk and uncertainty by deciding that risk is measurable. You can put a number, a probability on it, and claiming that uncertainty, which is unknowable, is therefore not worth talking about. I think that's like factually wrong. There's all sorts of Bayesian models in economics and different models that account for the fact that people have beliefs about probabilities, but that those beliefs aren't like a fixed point. They're not like, it's not like, I know exactly that the probability when I go to a roulette table that if I put my money on black, I'll win with 49% chance. It'd be more like, look, I have some sort of beliefs about this is the probability, but then there's some sort of confidence level. I have some sort of beliefs about how likely that probability is to actually be the true probability. And we've done a lot of work to like develop these models to where like, we have these learning models where people get signals and they refine their probabilities as they go on making decisions and getting more information. So I just like don't agree with that statement at
yeah,
all.
I agree completely with you. I think, you know, there's a lot of research, Nobel Prize winning research talking about the idea of bounded rationality and, you know, how people make decisions. And I, for one, prescribe to the idea that people are learning all the time. And so, sure, the very first time I go up to a roulette table, I might not know the rules. I might not know any of the probabilities of winning or losing, but I'm probably going to play again. And now I have a new piece of information in my information set. And now I can update my, you know, priors. So I can update my beliefs. And the more I play, the more I learn, I'm going to get better and better at understanding the game until I ultimately make good, what we would call economically good decisions. And so I agree with Forrest in that. I think the authors completely disregard this. And I think economists work really, really hard to incorporate this idea of learning in a lot of models.
I think one more thing that's like problematic is, so John actually sent me a SpongeBob meme that relates to something on page 93. John, do you want to say it or do you want me to?
Basically that everything has a 50% chance of ever happening because it either happens or it doesn't.
Yeah, so like that's a problematic way of viewing uncertainty or risk. On page 93, halfway down, they're talking about this idea of like, well, you know, you should get your children to learn Chinese, but maybe that's actually not a good idea. So the chance, well, I'll just read the quote. Similarly, the learn Chinese option seems to be based upon a notion that by the time these kids grow up, China will be running the world economy, but it's equally likely that as we have no way of probabilistically estimating that outcome versus any other, that China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Equally likely means something very, very different than that there's uncertainty about something. And so I just didn't see any value in the first part of this other than just, and maybe they're just trying to kind of bring home the point that like uncertainty exists. And like, that's what we're going to use as our main explanation for driving micro.
Yeah, like I think it would have been better if they talked about it in terms of like people making decisions on their own. Like thinking about now currently in kind of time of COVID, there's a lot of people who are just, they are literally uncertain about kind of their job prospects. They're just uncertain about like where their next paycheck is coming from. Is unemployment coming? And that is truly uncertain. But then risk would be something to the effect like, I'm going to quit my job and try to find another one during this time, right? And so there's a risk, there's an inherent risk in doing that. There's also some uncertainty, you know, on what you're doing. But I just wish they, in some way, kind of related it back to, I don't know, the stories that they were trying to tell. I just didn't like the discussion very well. But I ultimately understood the point that they were trying to make is that just the idea of maybe miscalculating risk or the idea of facing uncertainty is for a lot of people, especially, you know, I think we should be emphasizing on the lower end of the income spectrum, right? Almost none of this really applies, I would think, to people on the top 10% of income distribution.
Or people that are solidly in the top 5%.
Right. Yeah. That was weird.
All right, keep going. Sorry, we'll come
no,
back.
No. That's it, right? So, yeah, that's it.
I guess my question would have been, so, I mean, I think I get what they're saying, that like the future is just unpredictable, like no matter how many economic models and statistics you crunch through those. Is there like a place that you guys would have liked to take the conversation? Like with the knowledge that you can calculate confidence levels and stuff like that?
No, I actually would leave economics out of it. I would have just talked about it almost like psychologically and just from a pure like behavioral standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like people are really bad at estimating risk, right? They a lot of times, you know, they underestimate, you know, really, really large, impactful, you know, negative events, and then they like really overestimate the probability of like a small negative event happening. Like this is documented. So if they would have just talked about more of like the behavioral component of how people interpret and, you know, synthesize risk, like I would have thought that would be much more impactful to talk about like why are these stressors?
Sure. I agree with that too.
Yeah, I agree. I also just think like they just didn't need this part. Like, what's more important for their story is what's coming next about kind of, okay, here are the things that are driving this stuff.
So they kind of split it up, right, into kind of like four like kind of key drivers of kind of micro level uncertainty. And so I'm just going to kind of list them, in that they had what the increase in capital competition. They had this idea of automation. Then they had this idea that like demography was playing a role in uncertainty. And then lastly, they ended on immigration. And so I liked how they kind of talked about each one of these and its impact. I like some of them more than others, but.
Yeah, I agree with a couple more than another two. Maybe we should just take them one by one and kind of talk about whether we agree or what, sure, what we agree and what we disagree with. So when we talk about an increase in capital competition, that's the first one that they set up. And to me, this one's very confusing. It's like before this chapter, they're setting up that like, oh, you know, we had all these, this labor deregulation and things like that. Labor is much more competitive. But now they're saying, okay, capital is much more competitive because of things like Amazon. I'm going to defer to you on this one, Jason. But my impression is that like the returns have to go to somewhere. They got to go to capital. Yeah. They have to go to labor. Right. And I'm like, it's hard to argue that they're going to neither of those. You know, they're not going to capital or labor in the current environment we live in. So maybe you could.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, so I guess the idea, what they're trying to say is like the distribution of the kind of distribution of returns going to capital has been diminishing alongside kind of the returns to labor through the income spectrum. Because, I mean, you clearly we see, I mean, there's tons of research dedicated to looking at the concentration in a lot of industries. I mean, John Oliver has had had a really good episode of his show that talks about kind of these new conglomerates that are forming and that concentration is developing in just a variety of different industries. And so people, capital owners own, right, these businesses. Shareholders then also own these businesses. And so it's just that we're seeing, I think, much more concentration there. And so that's, I think, the issue that they're kind of highlighting.
Can you have, so there's some things like across these explanations that seem inconsistent to me, but even within this explanation about increased capital competition, can you have like record stock market highs, you know, shout out to Trump, shout out to Biden. We reached record highs a few days ago. Can you have record kind of highs in equity markets and at the same time make the argument that like, there's no returns to capital and there's no returns to labor? Or are you saying that like the returns to capital, that just like the distribution is being more skewed?
That's right. That's exactly
right. I didn't get
right.
that out of the, okay.
No, they didn't say that at all. That would be, that's my like own interpretation of what they're trying to say. Maybe taking it, you know, a second, you know, level up, but it's more so like we hear these stories through COVID, like that, you know, the 35 richest billionaires, you know, doubled their wealth during this time. Well, I mean, that's exactly what I'm describing, is that like capital returns are going to the richest people instead of being more equally distributed amongst all capital owners.
So they end that discussion of this first point about like an increase in capital competition on page 99. And they use this example of Manchester United. And it's very hard for me to see why, like, this is a relevant example at all.
I mean, did they not have radio? Right? I mean, like, so the difference between watching a Manchester United game on TV and listening to it on the radio 40 years ago is just, you know, the medium. But, like, you were still reaching millions of fans. Right around England, it wasn't just 70,000 people like they stated were able to see and you know experience this game. I mean, people have been listening to the radio and experiencing, you know, sporting events for a very long time. I don't know. I didn't buy that.
The last two sentences on page 99 before the paragraph break say the result is a handful of really big winners with quasi monopoly status at the top. And a very long tail with everyone else earning a fraction of their returns. If you take this as a model of what is happening in sectors everywhere, you can see that most people are going to be in that long tail with low returns. I have no idea why we would use Premier League soccer as our model for what's happening in the economy as like a general like model with some sort of external validity. Like I found the first one kind of weak.
I don't disagree.
One of them is English. They have to bring up, I think, contractually, soccer once per book.
I mean, they should have talked about like the, you know, the basically the merging of then the beer industry. I think that's a really good example of what they're trying to talk about. You had all of these, you know, you have all these capital owners in the beer industry, and then you continuously see these merging of huge firms that just eat up market share so that you have a few big winners on the right side of the income spectrum. And then you have all these little microbrews on the left-hand side that are kind of like fighting, that are kind of just fighting for whatever returns that they can get. I mean, that like makes a little bit more sense to me.
All right. Next up is the gig economy and automation.
I think these are two separate things, right? Like, I don't know. I did not love their automation discussion. I mean, at least there was a point in the book where they kind of tempered the automation fever in a really good way. They talked about an MIT study that indicated like half of all jobs would be automated away. And then they talked, and then there was another study that said, well, it's actually only like 30%. And then there's another study that was like, oh, it's only 9% of jobs are going to be automated away.
But it's a weird discussion.
It is a weird discussion. Then why even talk about it? Like, if it's not an issue.
Right. No. It's like people internalize the front part of that news. They internalize the MIT study, which is like, oh crap. Like if I'm driving a truck, right? Like I'm going to lose my job. But it's like, so people internalize that news, but they don't internalize the revisions of like, okay, it's actually 9% instead of 50%, which is weird to make a sort of an implicit claim about what news people are internalizing, what people aren't internalizing, because they're going to make this claim that like, okay, people are ticked off about automation. They're worried about losing their jobs. Mm-hmm. And later on in the chapter, they're going to say like, actually, like, no, you're not, like, don't worry. And
I mean, there's the other thing, you know, I do this in my class when I teach managerial, and of course, I don't know if you do too. But when I teach like the microeconomics, NPR has a fantastic, and Planet Money have a fantastic website where you can go and they have listed out what is the probability that your job will be automated. And so since I teach a bunch of finance kids, I always go to like financial, you know, analyst. And it's like 98% probability that your job's going to be automated away. And so then we have a discussion about that. And, you know, I did appreciate the discussion they had in the book, because it parallels a lot of what we talk about in class. And that is, there is absolutely going to always be a need for a human element in that kind of financial analysis position in finance. You're going to have people making deals and shaking hands and exchanging information in a way that, you know, AI and machine learning just can't do. And so, sure, it's that stuff. Maybe we can generate more data, but someone's got to be able to interpret it and synthesize it and, you know, make decisions with that. So.
Yeah, I definitely see like machine learning and AI becoming a source of like a stressor, like of anger. But yeah, economically, it seems like it's not a problem. I appreciate them kind of being honest about that, like saying that, you know, in the long term, very few jobs are actually going to be automated. And in fact, it will probably help create more jobs. And I liked.
Yeah, that was a good discussion.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I don't think I'd ever heard like the argument that technology, in a way, cutting down jobs and can actually create more jobs. I thought that was really interesting.
If you own the prosciutto firm,
that's right.
You'll be fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was
don't talk about something either that I think is really important, is the kind of the composition of GDP in this country, right? And we're moving completely, not completely, that's a bad word, but we're moving very, very heavily to service-oriented economy. And it's really hard to automate service jobs. I'm always going to have, there's someone's going to have to cut my hair, right? Like, we're not going to have robots to do that. someone's gonna have to tend bar and wait tables and do those things, right? We just can't machine learn that away. And I don't think we can just generate as, and they love to talk about this in the book, but as much as Japan tries, I don't think we're gonna get, you know, just robot waiters and waitresses.
My advisor told me when I took this job at Notre Dame, he's like, you know, Forrest, like there's a significant chance that like you are going to be replaced by a MOOC or a massively open online course. And like Greg Mankiw is going to teach all the principles of micro students for the rest of time. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. He might be right. And then like John is going to manage all this stuff and John will still have a job. Greg Mankiw will still have a job. And,
you'll just be a TA.
Yeah. You know what? And I'd be very happy doing that. I don't know. Like the Luddites have been proclaiming that, you know, these mills are going to destroy, you know, employment for a long time. And like, they haven't been right yet. That's not saying that it'll never be right, but like,
So are we thinking about this wrong though? Are we thinking about the wrong side of the income spectrum? Right. I mean, it's so hard for us to think about, you know, the bottom 10% or the bottom 15% of the income distribution. Because
that kind of leads into the gig economy stuff. They're very negative on the gig economy. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know. I guess I'm not in the bottom 10% of the income distribution, but like, I wanted to drive an Uber. John, did you drive an Uber for a little bit?
I did, yeah, for about 4 months.
Did it stress you out?
No, but it is, I do remember it being a little more challenging to make like good money on it, trying to balance, like just gas usage, parking, where to be in the right place. But like, that's going to go along with like really any job, really. And definitely any thing where you're like a business owner. But like my concern with the gig economy too, is like, aren't they really hard on like allowing these workers to like join unions? I think I saw recently that DoorDash or something like fired some people, or no, Instacart just recently fired like 10 people who like voted that they wanted to join a union.
Well, that's illegal.
I am like super confused about like the current state of whether these people are allowed to unionize or not, and like how I should even, I actually don't know how to think about it, you know. So Uber will tell you like, if you let them unionize and become something other than contractors, that's going to impose a huge cost on us. And like, Uber is already not profitable. Like, if they have to give their workers, you know, healthcare benefits and things like that, you know, you could imagine like Uber's, they're already in the red. They'll be even more in the red. And so like, it just wouldn't be a sustainable business model. So I think it comes down to, which I don't know the answer to, is like, how much of this is like people using flexibility in a positive way and supplementing their income in a positive way, giving them more choice versus like, certain types of full-time employment being shifted to the gig economy, which now all of a sudden, like, you don't have the labor protections that you might if you owned a taxi cab medallion or you're renting one out or whatever that scheme is. I don't know.
I would have liked to see their take. I would have liked to seen their take more so like on a job that I'm much more familiar with, but that's like adjuncting.
Yeah,
because I think of adjuncting as like kind of like a gig economy. And I know though, like I knew when I was in graduate school, I was an adjunct at another university just to make some side money. But I knew people like that was their full-time job. They adjuncted at like 3 or 4 different schools, had like 12 classes they were teaching all throughout the, you know, the week. And they were just barely scraping by, no health benefits, no nothing, because they never had enough money or never had enough time. They were never full-time employees at university.
Yeah, to be that dumb guy, what is adjuncting?
that, like, I'm an adjunct professor at Holy Cross, in addition to being a full-time professor at Notre Dame, where it's like a part-time position where it's yeah. very much like, you teach this class, we're going to give you $2,500 or $5,000 or $10,000, or in like a nice business school, or we're going to give you $50,000 or, you know, something like that.
Sure. Okay.
But, you know, it kind of comes down to, they give this notion of like contingency workers in the book, but like I looked up the BLS or the Bureau of Labor Statistics definition of contingency workers, and it's like, you, in order to be a contingency worker, you can't expect to continue to do it in the future for like the long term. And so I feel like when they're talking about people that are Uber drivers or whatever part of this gig economy, like, if you responded to this labor survey and you said like, yeah, I plan on, you know, I'm an Uber driver or whatever, and like, I plan on doing this for the long haul, like, you would not be a contingency worker. So I thought like their measure was somewhat flawed in trying to determine what part of the economy is part of the gig economy. And like, look, that's probably too harsh a criticism of the authors. Like, that's just a tough thing to figure out in general. Like, what is the size of the gig economy? I don't know.
Well, so we had these two, you know, I was not very much on board with these first two discussions for a variety of reasons that we kind of just talked to. But the last two, I definitely resonated more with me and how there could be absolute, you know, pain points for people that generate private anger. And so the demography one, I thought was a really poignant one. I mean, it's something that we see all the time in the news. There's like a million memes about, you know, boomer generation, what they were given and how the new generations don't have, you know, nearly as much help. And so I thought this was a really good argument.
So for Jason, as someone who's about to become a boomer.
Stop it. You don't become a boomer.
Exactly what a boomer would say.
exactly what a boomer would say. No, I agree. I had never thought about this idea. I thought about the idea that, look, demography can be a problem. It can be a problem if you have a large percentage of the population that isn't working and aren't being productive in the economy, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, like, resources have to be divvied up, like real resources have to be divvied up by everyone in the economy. But they made a good point about like the political power of the elderly population that I just don't think about. Like, I don't think about kind of like, what is Biden doing in terms of what was the example? Like this, like cancer moonshot.
Yeah. On right.
Page 106. And like, yeah, you know, I sort of anecdotally hear that like the AARP is like the strongest political lobbying group in the country, like the American Association of Retired Persons. Like, they have a ton of political power, and I tend to like not think about that in terms of how policy is dictated. But I thought they gave some good examples about like why this is actually important.
Right. I mean, not to make a joke of it, but like, they talk about how the baby boomer generation basically went to school for free, right? And then, mm-hmm. you know, we have your $1.7 trillion in student loan debt, right? And then we're giving $1.5 trillion tax cuts to, you know, the business owners who, again, we're seeing those business owners kind of the amount of business that they own, you know, I should say the amount of wealth that they own kind of very concentrated. So it's going to very few people, those tax cuts. So I get it. I get the public outrage, right? Or I guess the private anger that the book generates.
So right now, like, we completely subsidize K-12. It's like 13 years of education. And we've landed on this model fairly recently, like within the past 50 years, of like, oh no, if you want to get the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th year of education, you're actually going to have to put some skin in the game. You're actually going to have to pay for this. And so we're making this decision on the margin of like, okay, we agree that 13 years of education, or we somewhat agree, is like, we're going to publicly fund this. And like on the margin, do we want to use public funds to subsidize 14 through 17 years of education, like an undergraduate degree? I don't have any sort of strong opinions on this. I guess I fall in the camp of like, I'm not opposed to, after 12th grade people, you know, if you want to continue on, given like high dropout rates and things like that, like if you want to continue with education, that's fine, but like you should be a little bit invested in it. And, maybe the rise in college tuition is like more than you think is like appropriate for, what constitutes reasonable skin in the game. But Jason and I benefit from this. So like,
yeah, I mean, we're
self-servingly, like we're happy with like,
we're at elitist institutions in our ivory tower. So.
Yeah. And as someone who actually didn't go to college either, like I like all this conversation right now about, you know, forgiving student loans and stuff. Selfishly, part of me is also like, I don't want them to forgive student loans. Like I've definitely benefited. Like I do well for myself without having to have gone to college. And part of me is definitely like, well, why, you know, if they put their skin in the game, at, like the way you put it, then why do I have to put my skin in their game?
That's right. Yeah. And there's something super inequitable about like, if you imagine, like if you forgive all student loans, like the people that are going to benefit the most from that are not like what Jason was sort of talking about earlier about this bottom 10% who like weren't going to college. Like they weren't racking up student loan debts. If you're worried about redistribution and things like that, which the Biden administration is, like if you forgive student loan debts, like you are benefiting wealthy people. You're benefiting wealthy people who like paid for college, but like, and had student loans. But at the end of the day, like, you know, the bottom of the income distribution is not racking up a ton of student loan debts relative to like the middle of the income distribution.
Is this the progressive left's trickle down economics?
It's very convoluted if it is.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the idea that if we give the middle, right, we'll just call it we'll just say 50% in the middle. If we give them relief, that they're going to go out and spend all that money elsewhere, and that'll ultimately trickle down and rising tide lifts all ships. Right. That was a trickle down economics argument.
That's not the way they talk about it, though. I feel like the
no, they don't. No. Like, I'm just coming to a realization. I think we need to talk to Art Laffer and see what he thinks about.
Uh-oh.
Force, you know him pretty well, right? You can get get a hold of Art.
Yeah. I mean, like we text a lot.
Old chums.
We actually don't. I wish. But I the way they talk about it mostly is like, oh, this is like so unfair to students to have the student loan debt. And
yeah, they do.
That's right. Problematic. Like people that take out loans that afterwards say like, oh, this is very unfair. Like, well, you did have a choice. Like
I think we could talk about like there's definitely issues with kind of predatory lending behavior at for-profit institutions that, you know, the data suggests that most of kind of loan defaults and the accumulation of loans happens at these for-profit institutions where people are the graduation rates are just exceptionally low. So people are taking out tons of loans to go to like University of Trump or University of Phoenix or whatever it might be, and they just don't graduate, right? And so now they're on the hook for paying that back. I'd be less concerned with someone who graduates from William & Mary, right, or University of Michigan or Michigan State or something like that, because most likely those graduation rates are significantly higher and the job prospects coming out are just much better.
That's right. But like, if I take out a mortgage, I mean, let me ask a separate question. How bad do you feel for the people in 2006 that took out these adjustable rate mortgages that started off at 3% or 5% or whatever, and then shot up to 10% or 15% 2 years later. And, you know, there's at least anecdotal evidence that like these adjustable rate mortgages were part of the housing collapse where, you know, people wanted to give these mortgages. They start off these teaser rates, very low interest rates, and then they ramped up.
I think it really depends again on like the idea of, is this predatory loan lending, right?
Yeah, were these
lenders giving out these adjustable rate mortgages knowing that fully well that they're going to sell this mortgage to someone else to hold the bag, and that they only care about taking on their cut off the top, the mortgage generation.
But everybody did that. Everybody sold them to Fannie. Yeah, they still do.
And that's what I'm saying is like that I think is the issue, right? Is this kind of loan lending? It wouldn't be an issue if they're trying these kind of tactics with the upper 10% of the income distribution, because it frankly probably wouldn't matter. And secondly, the education level, unfortunately, of the upper 10% is radically different than the lower 10%. And they probably understand much better kind of what they're doing.
I don't know. I feel like you're being, for my taste, you're being a little bit paternalistic, and you're not giving enough credit to all people.
Individuals?
Making informed decisions. But
I disagree. Like, I think that, you know, society very much tries to force people into going to college and without a lot of viable alternatives. And so people feel like the only way that they can get by or get ahead is to go to school. Like that is, mm-hmm. You are force fed that through college. And as a result, like if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't know where you want to go, then you might pick you're 18 years old, you're going to pick maybe something wrong. And, you know, then you ultimately are paying for that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's what, like, the other part of me, that's why I said, like, part of me feels, you know, upset about talking about student loan forgiveness. But the other part, and probably the part that I care for more, is that it's a lot of my friends who are deep in debt, and like family members who are deep in debt, and they definitely just knew that they had to go to college. That, like, at our school, talking about going to like the career center and like getting a job in like welding or something, that was like, that's where like there's a stigma. That's where like, you know, the kids who dropped out of high school were going. And go ahead.
No, I just think it's like there's a deeper systemic problem that like the book doesn't address, and we don't talk about it, but it's this idea of the United States healthcare system and the job lock that people experience, right? Mm. Why do they push people to go to college? Well, because you want healthcare. Like, you know, of course, yes, you want to make, you know, money, and they cite all these statistics about how much money you make, you know, with a college degree versus not. But I mean, like, let's not steer people, you know, let's not, whatever. There, I mean, it's healthcare, right? If you don't have a job, you don't have healthcare. And I think that's one thing that the book doesn't address as much in this chapter that I think, like, that aids a huge amount in terms of like risk and uncertainty.
Well, don't they say at some point that like, like major disease like cancer is the number one cause or one of the primary causes of bankruptcy and uncertainty for any individual?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. But I mean, I would have loved to see this chapter just dive into like maybe a lot more on the U.S. healthcare system. They talk about the NHS, London's NHS, and how expensive it is. And, you know, there's this intergenerational trade-off and what they're doing there. But they don't talk about like how expensive and how kind of just terrible the United States healthcare system is.
I saw some funny memes on the internet and in Trump's last days in office about like, okay, Trump has waited till right now to release his healthcare plan. We didn't get it, but
I heard he's opened up his MAGA office, right? So I think we might see a new political party. Maybe we'll get a new healthcare plan.
along the lines of uncertainty, please. I will say that not being able to like see what Trump is posting on Twitter has generated some uncertainty and some stress in my life.
Oh, interesting.
I like being able to see the Trump Twitter feed and kind of see what's going on in his brain. And when he's been like radio silent for the past 2 weeks, it's like, what is he doing?
Like, you're like, it's like that quiet guy in the corner. You're like, what is he doing? Why isn't he talking? Why isn't he partying with everyone?
Yeah, it's a little scary. So that's my own private stressor right now, is Trump not having a Twitter.
That's funny. What do you think of the immigration section?
I loved it. I thought
it was funny. Actually, I agree. Yeah.
I mean, it felt like most of it was like, look, rich people don't care about immigration because it doesn't affect them. And like people at the bottom of the income distribution do because it does. And it's like, yeah. And like, that's really, really overlooked.
But then didn't they say that at least in Germany, like where the Syrian refugees went was not in the, I don't know, north side, which is, you know, where most of the people who were anti-immigration live. It was mostly like in the richer, I don't even, like, maybe not neighborhoods, but like parts of the country.
I thought they were talking about like the political party, that the political party, this AFD, like resonated in the poor parts of the country where immigration had impact.
But then they said that the refugees didn't go there.
Yeah, okay. I thought maybe I read that wrong too, but I thought they talked about how the people who were the poorest, who resonated with this party, were probably the least impacted by immigrants coming to Germany. But I think, like, you know, the United States, it just sounded exactly like the rise of kind of like populism and nationalism here in the United States. And so I thought that was just, for me, it was really interesting to make that parallel back to what we've been kind of experiencing over the last 4 years.
Yeah, and to y'all's point, on page 114, second full paragraph at the end, they said, they also had the sense to allot refugees to areas that have the capacity to support them, primarily in the South and Southwest, the richest parts of the country. So you guys are right about that. Now, that being said, like, I guess this kind of comes back to this idea of like, what are people's beliefs relative to what is like empirical data? So I was making a claim earlier that like, all right, if you think that like people are worried about automation because news stories are saying that like people are, there's going to be self-driving trucks and things like that, and 50% of jobs are going to be taken over by robots or whatever. But then like, you don't think people are updating on news that says that, nah, it's actually much less than you thought. Like, I kind of have a tough time reconciling that internally with like this idea that like, I believe this immigration story that like immigration causes political polarization along income distribution, like along the income distribution. But at the same time, like if it's the case that in Germany, like actually like refugees were being allocated to richer counties and things like that, then like that's a little bit inconsistent on my part. So I don't know where to kind of stand on that.
Yeah, I don't know either. I like the story that they were telling. I don't know. John, I actually wanted to ask John, you know, being in Arizona, your state is probably much more kind of impacted by immigration than maybe what Flores and I see kind of out here in Indiana. Mm-hmm. Do you see, I mean, again, you might be in your own little social bubble right now because COVID and stuff like that.
Right.
But kind of in the past 4 years, did you see kind of a serious rise in kind of that populism and like anti-immigration?
It's hard to say. I think so. And I think I was mostly surprised that a lot of like even the Mexican population is wants to cut down on illegal immigration. I think that was most surprising to me. Yeah,
it's surprising me too.
But I mean, it also kind of makes sense. Like my family, you know, my mom was the first born in America, as far like in my generation, but her family came over completely legally, got their visas and everything and their citizenship. So, there's a bunch of division within my own family. Some people, you know, one side of my family definitely thinks that there is a lot of just hate speech going on, and it's mostly about Mexicans, you know, coming to our country. And then the other side thinks that they shouldn't necessarily lump themselves in because they did come over legally. They worked super hard in order to, you know, get to the class that they're in. Like, they're all teachers and business owners and hard workers with families. And so they don't quite lump themselves in with a lot of, like, just a lot of the different things and I guess like uncertainty that illegal immigration brings because of people are coming over and we're not checking their passports or their IDs, then how do we know that they, you know, aren't somehow associated with cartels or whatever kind of speech or language or way that they want to look at it. So I think in Arizona, it's kind of similar to that too. There's just a lot of division, but people are definitely directly impacted by it. And it's really weedy. It's hard to say exactly, like, you know, if there's one side or another. I just think it might be a little bit louder here than it would be in Indiana.
I think it goes, to Brittany Forrest's point, I think maybe a little back into it is that, you know, people see the first story and then they get kind of energized in this political sense and kind of like this anger kind of is generated, and then they're in this echo chamber and they don't really, you know, update their priors. And so they don't see who's here legally and who here is illegal, right? Or who's citizens and who's not. They just then start dividing everyone up by race. And I think that's, you know, if I were in that position, if I were, you know, first generation, you know, Mexican American and came here illegally, I mean, I'd be angry at maybe as well, kind of like maybe some of your family members are at people coming in legally, because then it's like all the rhetoric is aimed at everyone, right? And I get lumped in that, and you know, I don't want to be in that pile. I shouldn't be in that, you know, right. lumped in that cohort.
Just as a note, like Jason, like, we are impacted by immigration a lot, but in a positive way.
Yeah, that exactly.
So, universities are these wonderful places that are like hubs for immigrants. That, like, you know, I don't feel displaced or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we kind of to the author's point of, oh, we're solidly in the top 5%, and so we don't worry about that.
yeah, I'm not going to tell you exactly where I fall in that income distribution.
In that top 5%, yeah, but especially, you know, after you sell a book with, you know, however many copies, but anyway, right. But you know, I think we're blessed in some sense to be in the position we are, where we encounter people from different cultures that aren't U.S. citizens, and it's in a very non-threatening environment.
That's true, but like we don't need to be in the bottom 10% of, you know, the income distribution to appreciate the challenges that people in that part of the distribution face, right? In the same way that like a good cancer doctor doesn't need to have cancer or have beaten cancer to be a good cancer doctor, right? They can still appreciate kind of what people are going through and, you know, help, I don't know if that's the right word, advocate, go to public office, right, and try to help everyone. I don't know. I would have liked more from the book to say that, like, sure, yeah, they're unaffected, but even though they're unaffected, they can still appreciate and empathize, and still there's a lot of people that work really hard to make sure that you know, everyone has, you know, equal rights and representation, to, you know, stuff like that. I don't know.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
I think what I'd be really curious, and I don't know if you guys have any information or stats that would be interesting, but it's, I feel like it's so hard to get good information on immigration that's not just so heavily politicized. Like, I know I've heard a lot of stuff that, like, contrary to what might be, like, easy to think, is that a lot of, I think it was, like, second generation, or maybe it was first generation, like, born in America, Mexicans are, like, the most, like, they contribute the most, like, they're the highest contributors to, like, GDP or something, like, or, like, taxes or something like that. Among like other things that say that immigration is actually really good for the economy. And then there's obviously the stuff on the other side that says like it's really bad. Like these people don't pay taxes, they get free healthcare. I think there's a lot of things that aren't true.
The statistics are overwhelmingly that like immigrants give more to the public dole than they take away.
Yeah.
And generate more for economic growth than they.
I mean, talk about intergenerational trade-offs. Like the older baby boomers, they need immigration. Like they need it to happen because the people on the younger side of the baby boomer generation, they're going to be there. It's a fight for their Social Security trust fund. And the only way to kind of refill that trust fund is to get populations younger and to get more people paying into it so that the older generation has enough to kind of retire on. I mean, we have this conversation with our students all the time. Like if I was in that baby boomer generation at the younger end, I would be advocating for immigration. And the book actually touches on that a little bit in terms of like that they talk about the solo growth model and the inputs to kind of drive GDP.
Oh, I mean, population being variable.
I mean, population being a variable, like that is something that would drive growth. It's just increasing population. More people need more things. So we have more businesses, more income being spent, more taxes. I mean, it's just, sure. I mean, yeah.
You want to change demographics, like just adopt different immigration policies.
That's exactly right.
Like you can directly change demographics through that policy tool. No, that's a great point. I should have said that a long time ago. That's perfect. Yeah. Hmm. All right. So maybe I will kind of wrap it up. I thought they did a nice job on 116 through 118 on setting up what is going to be what I think is the best chapter and the most interesting chapter. Is like, okay, here's a set of ideas that look, when we have problems, we can adopt these different things. And so that'll be the subject of next episode. I don't think we need to talk too much. There's a little bit of setup that they do at the end of this chapter, but I don't think we need to discuss in detail. I'll just kind of summarize with the last bit starting on 116. Let's bring all this together. There are two faces of public anger. The first is a tribal energy, a motivating and potentially violent strain of our instinct to form groups that is associated with our fears, threats, and a worldview which is decidedly zero sum. The tribal anger we are witnessing today predates the most recent global economic traumas, although they have accelerated its force. We've also emphasized a second and totally different side to anger. Anger is an expression of a legitimate voice, which is genuine grievances and has not been listened to. We've identified a series of fundamental economic triggers, devastating cyclical mismanagement of the economy, especially in Europe, extremes in wealth and income inequality, a neutering of the nation state under globalization, a corrupted financialized elite under crises, as an opportunity to bypass democratic process. And they keep going on. I'm going to skip a paragraph. Private anger, the subject of this dialogue, is a very different species, but it is the micro side of the macro version of angrynomics we discussed in the previous dialogue. In contrast to moral outrage in the public sphere, private anger reveals something internal. It is not a reason-based call for legitimate rebalancing. Kicking one's car out of frustration really signals a demand for electric motors. The fundamental question is why we are so stressed, especially when on the face of it, we have never had it so good. Stress is primarily caused by things going wrong, also by uncertainty and change, specifically technological changes, demographic changes, increased insecurity due to deregulation and liberalization, and absence of voice, and increasing inequality. Anger as a theme unites the public and private, the micro and the macro. It helps us make sense of political developments that otherwise appear chaotic and frightening. It also gives us a guide to what to listen to, what to contain, and hopefully what action to take. In the real world, of course, these factors are interacting to create what you and I have termed angry-nomics. The question now is, what do we do to reduce the anger? Ultimately, what we are trying to rewrite the software. So what do we need to do? And that's going to lead up to the last episode where we talk about what the author's policy proposals are. And I really, really like their menu of policy proposals as just like a set of ideas that you want to have in waiting for the event that you need to use them. So Milton Friedman was kind of famous. Milton Friedman is very different from these economists, but was famous for saying, look, what economists' job is to have a set of ideas waiting such that when things go wrong, we can interject those ideas. And, you know, with Friedman, you saw that with the Reagan and Thatcher administrations. And so I'm excited to talk about what's coming next in terms of these policy proposals.
So I know we have a very special listener out there. Forrest, did they talk about legal weed as one of their policy proposals?
That is a glaring omission.
Oh, my goodness.
Glaring.
But right. You know what? Let's put a pin in that.
All right.
As the podcasters say, let's put a pin in that. And we will talk about legal weed next time. And that's our foreshadowing for the fourth and final episode of our book club on Angry Nomics.